This is Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat.
Around the corner, touchdown, Ian Book! And we are all tied at 20.
Looney back to Huff for three.
Got it again!
That's a Big Ten Tournament Championship winner!
From 96.1 WSBT.
The Virginia Cavaliers are the national champions.
Here's Yohe with a steal, gives it up, and Johnson throws it down.
Fires, it's caught, touchdown, T.Y. Hilton.
The sports leader.
Hickory! Allow myself to introduce myself.
Here are your hosts, Darren Pritchett and Sean Stiers.
We thank you for joining us. Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat is on the air for this Thursday, April the 16th of 2020, brought to you by our longtime title sponsor and partner, Budweiser, locally distributed by United Beverage of South Bend, who urges you to stay home, stay safe, stay fun. By the Food Bank of Northern Indiana. Hunger is a story we can end. Find out how at feedindiana.org. And by Rossini's Pizza. Carry out your proud to bring home. Lincoln Way East in Mishawaka, across from Beeger School. We continue a sports beat from home. Sean Stiers and Darren Pritchett broadcasting from our respective homes. We have Jerry Janowski producing from our WSBT studios. We thank you for joining us. Prior to a little winter wonderland, it sounds like, over the next 24 hours or so here in the South Bend area. So we prepare for that, but then it's going to be in the 50s on the weekend, 50s and 60s next week. So possibly we're starting to turn the corner weather-wise. Sean, how are you?
I'm doing well today. It looks nice outside. It's still a little bit chilly, but good day and ready to get rolling on a busy show tonight.
No question. This is day number 35 working from home, and I have to admit, even though I'm a very positive person, I wondered a month into this, without any sports taking place on the court, on the playing field, how would this show work? And I've been pleasantly surprised. We have had really an easy time coming up with things to talk about, guests to get. And I'll tell you what. Today, I think we could do 4 hours, and I never would have thought that back on March the 11th or March the 12th when we started this. But there's so much going on right now. Some of it is speculation. Some of it is fact. But there's a lot of things circulating. Now, we have a couple of guests. Carter Carls will talk Notre Dame football recruiting at 5:30. Perfect timing because Pat Coogan, an offensive lineman from Marist High School in Chicago, picked the Irish over LSU, Ohio State, Texas A&M, and Oklahoma. He is a lifelong Irish fan. And I noticed in one of the quotes attributed to Coogan, he mentioned Notre Dame is ready to win a national championship, and he wants to be a part of that. So Coogan, a really interesting player, and I don't think he's getting the love from the star system, and I'll talk more about that later. I talked to somebody that's seen his tape, and we'll have Carter talk about Coogan, of course, coming up at the bottom of the hour. So some Notre Dame football recruiting talk to get to. Link Jarrett, the head coach of the Irish baseball team. The Irish were 11-2 overall, 3-0 in the ACC when the season was halted, and the Irish were on the road when the season was shut down. We'll talk about what that was like and looking ahead to future Notre Dame teams. We'll just talk baseball in general with Link coming up at 6:07. In the meantime, let me get to a couple of things that have popped up today. First off, we are getting the sense of our first professional sport trying to return. Now, without fans, but the PGA Tour has announced that on June the 11th, there's a tournament in Texas, and that tournament will take place with no fans. The first four events will take place with no fans, and then as we get closer to that four-week span ending, they'll make a decision about the following week and on down the line. But as of right now, a mid-June return of the PGA Tour is the plan. 28 events over 25 weeks. Recently, all the majors were reshuffled except the Open Championship, which, of course, is the British Open, known as the Open Championship. It's not going to be played this year, but the Masters in November. You've got the PGA Championship and the U.S. Open occurring in the fall. But it looks like, at least as of right now, the first professional sport to come back will be professional golf, and the PGA Tour is wanting to get going June 11th down in Texas. And again, no fans for the first four events, and that would cover an event in Michigan. And of course, Michigan in lockdown mode right now. Golf courses are closed, but there's the Rocket Mortgage Tournament up in Michigan, and I'm trying to remember what town that's in. I just saw this story come about, have not had a chance to research it. It might be in Grand Rapids. I could be wrong, but I'll see if I can check that during a commercial break. But July 2nd, the Rocket Mortgage Golf Tournament in Michigan will take place, at least as of right now, but it falls into that first 4 weeks of no fans. So if you're missing sports on TV, hey, you may become a golf fan all of a sudden because golf might be the first tournament or the first group of sports to come back.
It's in Detroit, by the way.
Okay.
And
ooh, that's a hot
spot.
I
just found that. Yeah, exactly. And that's what I was getting ready to say. I mean, the golf show just found a whole heck of a lot more content that you have on Saturdays. And we might be talking a lot of golf this summer, the way things are going right now. But, I mean, golf, I've always thought of the sports with the chance to come back, it seemed like golf would have the best chance because, you know, the fans are sort of more segregated anyway because you're spread out over a golf course. You don't have to worry about the grandstands and all that. None of the guys have to worry about anyone talking or taking pictures and stuff like that on their backswings. But, I mean, even while they're playing, they're a lot easier to keep apart. It's like, okay, this guy's going to tee off. You're going to stand 10 feet in that direction. You're going to stand 10 feet in that direction. And really, no one's going to have to come really close to each other. No one should have to worry about coming close to each other over the course of play.
All you need is the caddies with gloves on because you do have the pins that you have to grab. So if you put gloves on, I think that can take care of that issue. Disinfectant. It's not like regular golf where professional golfers and caddies use ball washers, so you don't have to worry about, you know, that being used by multiple people. So I agree with you. Golf was the one sport, it seems like, that could come back the quickest. And according to the PGA Tour, what they have announced today, June 11th, the tour will resume. And again, the first 4 weeks, no fans in attendance. Now, on the golf show Saturday, we're going to talk about this, and I asked John Foster from Warren and Tim Firestone from Blackthorn, who have both been a part of professional golf tournaments, what is the impact money-wise on these tournaments without fans buying tickets? And they'll get into that. And I know, I can tell you up front, the biggest problem will be charities losing money because of no fans in attendance. But we'll get into more on that on the golf show Saturday morning at 8 o'clock here on WSBT Radio. So the PGA Tour is the top storyline today. The NFL continues to push forward, as we've talked about. 1 week from tonight, the first round of the NFL draft will take place. And the NFL has announced today that May 9th, they will unveil their full NFL schedule. Now, there are contingency plans to shorten the NFL season. There are a lot of possibilities right now. A lot can change before we get to the fall. But the NFL is going to release the full schedule May 9th. And again, as we get closer to the fall, they may make adjustments. Possibly you have a half a schedule. Maybe you play just your division foes. Who knows what we might have to do? And who knows? Maybe we'll have a full NFL season. But the thing I've learned over the last 48 hours, Sean, and I think we're in line here, we're going to see professional sports come back way before college sports. That's the feeling I have listening to a lot of people who are in the know. It's just going to be complicated. You can't bring back student athletes to campus if the rest of the campus is shut down. It just doesn't seem feasible. It's a bad look. So just listening the last 2 days, we're going to have professional sports, it feels like, before we're going to have college sports. And I hope I'm wrong and maybe something will change, but that's the feel I've kind of grabbed over the last 48 hours.
Yeah, the two conference calls that took place yesterday, one with the vice president, which was predominantly about college sports, and the president talking to more the professional commissioners and some team owners and things like that, a lot of this different stuff. And I think it seems like just reading some of the quotes coming out of that, and we'll get into more detail on this in the second hour as well, but it seems like the point that especially college wanted to make clear is it's college sports and professional sports are two completely different things in the way that they can go about bringing their sports back and getting things rolling in the fall.
Well, let's bring in a soundbite, because Irish head coach Brian Kelly was on the Colin Cowherd show today, The Herd, and they were talking football. And there was one portion of the conversation I want to bring forth to our listeners, and it's something else to think about as contingency plans are being made for everything right now. So I'm going to let Colin Cowherd ask the question. You'll hear Brian Kelly's response, and we can comment on the back end. So this is courtesy of The Herd and Fox Sports 1 earlier today. Notre Dame head coach Brian Kelly with Colin Cowherd.
Let me just ask you this. Fundamentally, structurally, if you had to play January, February, March, would it be a big pain in the butt, or could you kind of slide it down a little bit and make it work?
I think we could make it work as long as it wasn't. I think we have to get through this. We can't have an overlapping semester, because then there's eligibility questions.
Okay.
That I don't know that we can really handle on the phone right now. So as long as there's not an overlapping semester situation, we can get through the semesters and everybody can tie up fall from winter and you know, spring from summer. I think we can do that. So I think there's enough models out there that we can get this season in. There may be some situations where, you know, we heard the other day that the mayor may not let anything happen in the city of L.A.
Yeah.
There may be some teams that have to play road games. And if that's the case, to play and get your season in at different sites, there may have to be those kinds of alterations to get a season in. We'll see what happens.
Okay, so that was Brian Kelly with Colin Cowherd on The Herd earlier today. Couple of things from that conversation. Under the example that Colin gave, playing the 2020 college football season in January, February, March of 2021, that would not be an issue with the overlapping semesters, from what I understand. If you went November, December, January, that could be an issue, because then you're dealing with two different semesters. This is the way it was explained to me. But okay. January, February, March would work. I talked to someone today that said they had heard that even February, March, April, into May is something that could be a possibility that's being talked about. So look at it this way. After spending some time thinking about this afternoon, put yourself in the shoes of college football commissioners and presidents of universities, just for a second. You're scheduled to start the season late August, early September. If you are told at some point you cannot have fans in the stands for half of the college football season, or maybe the entire football season as it lays now from late August to early December. Let's say you can't have any fans in the stands at all. Uh-huh. If you were a college football commissioner or a president of a university, wouldn't it make sense, knowing that is the possibility, or that's what you're being told, to just go ahead and wait until January or February to start the season? Because there's a chance if you wait, you could have fans in the stands. That leads to revenue. We were told yesterday maybe 25% of revenue for football teams come from people buying tickets. I'm not sure if that includes parking, concessions, but we'll just leave it at 25%. Right. So it would seem if you roll the dice and you wait until January or February to start, you might be rewarded and you could have some sort of a look of fans in the stands. It may not be normal, but you could possibly work something out. If you get to January and you still cannot have mass gatherings, well, you waited, you tried, but really it's no different in terms of playing football then compared to in the fall. You know what I mean? You're not really
right.
hurt in any way. You're taking a chance of adding more revenue and getting fans in the stands. And again, if it doesn't work out, I think it's worth the shot. And then you just start playing football either in January or February. Does that make sense?
No, I think it does. And I think that's what a lot of these college administrators, athletic directors, and coaches have to be starting to look at, like now, look at right now. What is our fallback position? And as you said, so that you're not tying it, so that you're not crossing over through two semesters because of the eligibility issue that Brian Kelly talked about. Of course, the bigger piece in this whole thing, okay, if there's no fans allowed in the stands, is that also connected to, are there no students on campus? Because then that still affects, when is the team going to be able to report to start working out and doing all these different things that they're not able to do right now. They weren't able to do anything in the spring. So far, summer has not been affected. But obviously, if they're pushing back into the winter and into next year for the season, that's going to mean the summer stuff is going to be affected as well. So it's, you know, all of that kind of ends up being connected. But I think that I think it's good that they're at least talking about this as an idea right now. But also, to circle back to what you're talking about, I just think it becomes a nightmare. And Brian Kelly said this as well. If you're sitting there in December, when theoretically your team is going to be going through its training camp, if you're starting your season in January, and the Los Angeles teams or whoever in California, wherever it happens to be, and they're not able to do anything, it obviously goes beyond just the ability to play games at home and things like that, because I've got to think that probably still means that even getting on campus is going to be an issue for them. But again, I mean, that's a long way away, but that's one of the issues that'll have to be worked out, is the whole, where are the hot spots still, and who's able to do what? Who's able to actually get on campus?
And Sean, so my takeaway today is that if, for example, the fall semester, students will not be on campuses, and it sounds like the universities and conferences are going to be unified. If one team can't play, nobody's going to play. But if you get into January and campuses open up and you're going to have classes in person, it would sound like that if there is a part of the country where you still cannot have mass gatherings, and LA is a prime example, they are talking about that at this present time,
right,
that we would go ahead and still play football. But in this case, for example, USC, UCLA, they would have all their games on the road, and that would be just the consequence of the situation. And I guess it's not fair, but it's better than no football at all. These teams are going to lose out on home revenue. I'm sure there's a way to balance the money in some fashion if they have a road game rather than a home game. I would assume something might be worked out. But that's sure a heck of a lot better than not playing at all. So there's just so many moving parts. But I think it's going to come down to this. At least it feels like when students come back to campus, that's what it feels like, we get to that green light stage.
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of the all clear. But again, when you have in any college campus, you are theoretically, you could have kids from all 50 states plus multiple countries congregating, you know. So when we talk about social distancing and all that, it just seems like we're still a ways off from anything close to that right now.
So now we can see kids in California entering the transfer portal to get out of California so they can have a normal season.
JT Daniels entering the transfer portal this afternoon, the USC quarterback.
Unreal. Unreal. Well, anything's possible at this particular time. Okay, so those are some of the things that have popped up today. I've got other stuff I can't even get to. Caesars released the over-under for NFL win totals, and this is something we can do in the coming days, but this is just for fun to throw it out there. The Patriots, they're over-under win total. You want to take a guess?
The Patriots?
Mm-hmm.
I'd say somewhere around 10 would be my guess.
How about 8.5?
That's... Their over-under is 8.5 right
now. Las Vegas knows, too, my friend. They're trying to tell us something. You know they don't just throw numbers out there. They've got the Bills at 9, and the Patriots are at 8.5.
Man.
Woof. I can see a lot of people taking the chance on the Patriots that they always figure it out, but they're going to have to figure it out without Tom Brady, and maybe Stidham is going to be the quarterback for New England. That's fun. On a normal day as we know it, that would be our top story, but right now it's a little far back. So craziness. So we'll get to the storyline, Bears, Colts, and other NFL storylines, over under win total at another time. We're going to spend a lot of time on the NFL draft next week. In fact, there was an interesting CBS Sports mock draft, 7 rounds with trades, and would you believe that Cole Kmet was the 3rd Notre Dame player off the board?
Really?
And Okwara, I would not believe that. And Okwara was behind him.
Really?
How about that for a tease? So that's something else I think we can get into on tomorrow's program. It was a wild mock draft with trades, but no Notre Dame players were taken in the first 2 rounds of this mock draft. And again, Cole Kmet was not in the top 3 Notre Dame players taken. And Okwara was not either. So someone made a big jump. In fact, you'll be shocked to hear the first player off the board. It's stunning. But we'll get into that tomorrow. Okay, we got to go to break right now. I'm sorry, that's such an awful tease, isn't it? I'll tell you, it's Troy Pride Jr. is the first player off the board.
Really?
Yes. Man. Yes.
No kidding.
Claypool goes 90th overall.
And who's the source on this?
That's CBS Sports senior writer.
Wow.
I mean, he's got trades galore. I mean, it's craziness, but it's one person's opinion. One person. But again, Kiper dropped Claypool from 30 to 48 in his mock draft this week. I just can't imagine a guy 6'4 that runs a 4.42 40 that's going to go 90th. Now, he's the 13th wide receiver off the board in this mock draft. I can't buy it. I can't buy it.
Not at all.
And I was not buying 50 overall yesterday from, or was it 48 overall with Kiper? I think it was 48. I wasn't buying that. 90? No, come on now. So that's something we'll put in our back pocket. But we've got Carter Carls next to talk Notre Dame football recruiting, including the Irish picking up a commitment from a lifelong Irish fan out of Chicago, another pretty good get for the offensive line. That's one of the storylines we'll talk about next as Sports Beat continues. John and Darren with you on 96.1 WSBT, the sports leader, and live on the Sports Beat app. In these times of nothing being normal, it's great to know that music can just allow us to take a deep breath, smile, and relax for a moment. Because Carter Carls is ready to talk Notre Dame football recruiting on the IndyInsider.com recruiting update. Carter is the Fighting Irish football recruiting insider for the South Bend Tribune, and he joins us, as always, on this Thursday on WSBT Radio with Sean Stiers and Darren Pritchett. Carter, it is always great to hear your soothing voice.
Especially when I'm using a phone that can be working, right? I mean, hopefully I sound good.
Hold it, I don't recognize that voice.
For the first time, we had controversy surrounding the Indy Insider report because the phone last week was fading in and out, but you're on a hard line now, so technically you are sound and ready to go.
Awesome. That's great.
All right. Let's don't waste any time because you're on the program on a perfect day as Notre Dame has landed a commitment from Pat Coogan, an offensive lineman, Marist High School in Chicago, and a lot of great programs very interested in Coogan, but it sounds like this is a lifelong dream for Pat to be a part of this Notre Dame football program.
Yeah, I mean, in the last 3 weeks alone, he got a scholarship offer from LSU, Texas A&M, Oklahoma, Ohio State. And that didn't really deter him from picking his favorite school. All along, he wanted to get that Notre Dame offer, and he got it at the end of last month. And it only really took him a couple weeks to think it over. I think right now, you know, some recruits are having a tough time making decisions because they need that one more visit, or in some cases they haven't visited certain schools yet. But in Pat's case, he's been to Notre Dame countless times. He was at the New Mexico game last fall, and so this was an easy decision. Didn't need to take any more visits or anything like that. And in Coogan, I think Notre Dame is getting a pretty good interior offensive lineman. He's a 6'5", 275-pound guy. He's probably going to either play guard or center. We'll see, just kind of depending on how the roster shakes out. But, yeah, this was Tommy Reese and Jeff Quinn, the offensive line coach, who were really heading his recruitment. And now they've got two offensive linemen committed, Coogan and Blake Fisher.
I'm going to ask a follow-up question, Carter, because I had the chance to have someone contact me that's watched a lot of Coogan film. And on top of that, the person that contacted me has had discussions with someone who evaluates offensive linemen at the Division I level. And what they said to me was, it is an absolute joke that Coogan is listed by all these alleged experts on these recruiting services as a three-star. What is your takeaway from the way he has been labeled as a football player right now?
Well, just kind of watching his junior season, I would lean a little bit more toward three-star. But, you know, the problem with this climate right now is we don't get to see these kids in camps. We'll see how much we're going to be able to watch of their senior seasons. And so I do need to watch more of Pat Coogan, admittedly. But if you just look at his offer list, I mean, every top school you can think of, for the most part, has offered him a scholarship. And typically that's a good indicator that, you know, these other schools, they don't think he's a three-star guy. You know, what keeps me from doing, from committing to, you know, the four-star label is just his size, his length, athleticism, all that kind of stuff you really look for in offensive linemen. I don't see the elite factor there yet, but certainly I still haven't seen a whole ton of him, and his senior year could change that. And all these other schools seem to think that this is a special talent, so I will defer to them. And look, I think Notre Dame, they really like what he can do on the interior, and it's all about where he fits. And you're not asking him to be an offensive tackle, a left tackle, right, or anything. So if he ends up being a center or a guard, I could definitely see him being a multi-year starter there if the roster shakes out that way.
So, Carter, what does the rest of Notre Dame's offensive line class look like right now? How do you see it kind of playing out here down the road?
You typically want to get an even dose of tackles and guards. Last year was different. They really wanted tackles, so they got two offensive tackles and nothing else. And so now they can take a bigger number. I'm thinking they will get four or five total offensive linemen, probably four. Right now they've got two committed. That's Blake Fisher, who he could play guard, but most likely, in my opinion, he's going to play offensive tackle. Pat Coogan, no doubt, will be on the interior. So you think, okay, maybe one more interior guy, one more tackle at the very least. On the interior, the number one target on the offensive line is Rocco Spindler. He comes out of Clarkston, Michigan. He's a four-star guy who is on the verge of five-star status. His dad was a number one overall draft pick once upon a time, Mark Spindler, and he's got a wrestling background. He's got the bloodlines. He's really got everything you need. He could be a four-star, possibly five-star defensive lineman if he wanted to, because he plays so well on both sides of the ball. So Rocco Spindler, if Notre Dame can land him, in all this talk about how this offensive line class has been a disaster, I think it's still salvageable and it can still be among the best in the recruiting class. And so Spindler's the key. Beyond him, you're going to need to get an offensive tackle. Caleb Johnson out of Florida and Matthew Wyckoff out of Texas, they're both planning to take an official visit to Notre Dame in June. Those guys are still pretty early with their Notre Dame recruitment, so I don't know if they would be in position to commit at that time, but with all the craziness in our world now, you never know. And so I think those will be two to watch. There's a couple other they've recently offered, but the way I see it, they add at least one more on the interior, hopefully Rocco Spindler, and then one offensive tackle.
Carter Carls from the South Bend Tribune breaking down Fighting Irish football recruiting on WSBT Radio. So why don't we get our weekly Will Shipley update out of the way. A very talented running back. The last time we checked in, Clemson and Notre Dame were leading the way. Anything new on that front?
Still think it's Notre Dame and Clemson. I mean, these are the two heavyweights going after them. Both teams have done a really good job recruiting them. There really is nothing that Notre Dame isn't doing to get Will Shipley. My only caution is they've put all of their eggs in the Will Shipley basket. So if they do not get him, they're going to have to move quickly. And with the current nature, the current climate, without visits, that could be tough to do. So Will Shipley really is the most important uncommitted target left on the board. And this has been a great approach by Notre Dame. They're involving multiple coaches. They're contacting him, but they're not badgering him. I think in this climate, a lot of coaches, there's the temptation to reach out to kids multiple times a day. I don't think Notre Dame's doing that. I think they've found that happy medium. Now, with Will, the interesting thing is, I think he's pretty unpredictable. His line of thinking changes every day. You know, he wants to commit in April one minute, and then the next he wants to take a visit to Notre Dame in June and see how that goes. What hurt Notre Dame is not getting that March visit from him, and so they've done everything they possibly can to try to bridge that gap. You know, have an academic advisor talk to him, have all the coaching staff talk to him. They've gotten about a dozen players on Notre Dame's roster reach out to him. Hmm. And Lance Taylor, he's got a couple of his former players, Christian McCaffrey and Bryce Love, talk to him over the phone. So this is an approach that is comprehensive from Notre Dame. If they don't land him, you know, you can't fault them for not getting him, but you fault them if they don't get them and the fact that they put all their eggs in that basket, and now it's a little shaky if they don't get them.
So, Carter, look into your crystal ball for a minute. Who do you think might be the next to commit to Notre Dame?
Well, you know, it's funny. I was going to write a story about this before things got a little crazy, just kind of mapping out who I think is the most likely to commit, you know, just kind of listing a few guys. The number one guy was Pat Coogan, so he's off the board. The number two guy almost could have been tied. It might have been number one, honestly, and that shows you how confident I am that he's going to land at Notre Dame, is Jason Onye, the defensive end out of Rhode Island. His school is exactly like Notre Dame, private, Catholic, and all male boys. So to me, he has said that he hasn't visited Notre Dame. That's the one roadblock, but that everything he's seen, heard, and watched about the school, the virtual campus tours he's been able to take, it seems exactly like his campus, like his high school. And so he was going to visit Notre Dame in March. Him and David Abiara, the other defensive end commit at Notre Dame, my thinking and my intel was both of those guys are going to commit in March. They just needed to visit Notre Dame. David Abiara, you know, he held off for a little bit after visits got canceled, but he decided a few weeks ago, you know what, why drag this out any longer? I'm going to commit. That could happen with Jason Onye. We'll see. That's what happened with Pat Coogan. A lot of these guys, there's some impatience where, do we really want to wait five more months when we know what school is our favorite? It's not like we're going to be taking any more visits. Let's just get it out of the way. So Jason Onye will be one to watch. Other than him, Rocco Spindler is a guy that I've said Notre Dame is in the lead for. I think they're in a great position for him. And then Ryan Barnes, the cornerback out of Maryland. I think Notre Dame's in a great position for him. But all these guys, it all comes down to, do they really need to take another visit? If they don't, then they could commit, you know, and they could change their mind any day now.
Wow, this has been like 2 weeks worth of information you've passed along already. So why stop now? Let's just keep rolling, Carter. 24/7 Sports updated rankings yesterday. This was a ranking of the 2021 class. Anything cool and exciting come out of that new ranking?
Absolutely not.
What a buildup.
I know. Well, you know, what the thing is, and I don't fault 247 and Rivals here, this is what it should look like. They have not been able to see anything the last, you know, 6 weeks at least. So, you know, how are you going to drastically change anyone's ranking when you don't get to see them and evaluate them? And that's going to be a problem, not just for recruiting analysts, recruiting websites, but also for coaches evaluating talent. I think of Brian Polian, the recruiting coordinator at Notre Dame. He was talking about how Notre Dame really, really went into verifying speed. You know, every coach in the nation thinks, every high school coach thinks that their kid runs a 4.440. Well, you know, prove it. Let's see the track times. Let's see a lasered 40 at you know, the Elite 11 camp. Let's see him actually do it and prove it, and not be some, you know, loose stopwatch that a coach is going to be pressing way too early. So, I think that is going to hurt Notre Dame and others, because how do you get that verified speed that you're looking for? A lot of these recruits that not just Notre Dame but others go after, their offers are contingent on these track times and these speed numbers. Like, if there's a question between, okay, we really like this guy, but if he runs a 4.7, might be too slow, but if he runs like a 4.5, then yeah, we'll take him. You know, that very well could be the difference in some of these guys, and not having that evaluation is really going to hurt a lot of teams. And then when you look at the recruiting analysts, a guy like David Abiyara, committed to Notre Dame's class, he's a three-star recruit on 247 and Rivals, very well could have been a four-star recruit when it's all said and done, but because he's not going to be at these camps and he can't be evaluated, he might not ever get that boost that he deserves.
Carter, my last question for you. The Notre Dame has the recruiting weekend planned for June. What do you know about anything going on there?
Yeah, they actually have two. It's one is the 12th through the 14th. The other one's the following weekend. The first one, the 12th through 14th, that's the real big one to watch. We always talked about how the March 20th weekend was big time for Notre Dame. They're trying to make that be big time for June 12th through 14th. They're trying to kind of replace that, since that never happened. The difference is, since recruits can take official visits, you're going to see recruits come from Texas and Florida and California, because they're all expense-paid trips. So this very well could be the biggest recruiting weekend of the offseason, the biggest recruiting weekend in a long time under Brian Kelly. We'll just see how it plays out. There's a lot of uncertainty right now with this pandemic, and the coaches are prepared for that. They thought that, hey, let's plan this just so if the government kind of permits these kind of things, the NCAA permits this to happen, then they'll be ready to do it. And if they're prohibited by health officials, then don't do it. And so it could happen. It could not happen. We'll see. I think the interesting thing would be, if it does happen, what kind of measures will Notre Dame take? Will there be social distancing? Will people be wearing masks? How many people are allowed in one room? I have no idea. I don't think anyone can speak definitively right now, but I think those are things that not just Notre Dame is having to consider, but other universities that are having these visits in June, because Notre Dame is not the only one planning these June visits. I know a lot of recruits are uneasy about this, and so I think Notre Dame would only do this if they get the all clear from the NCAA and health officials.
All right, final two questions for you, Carter. First off, what are you working on for the South Bend Tribune or IndyInsider.com?
Well, I got a lot of stuff coming this weekend recruiting-wise. Will Shipley is going to be on the Pot of Gold podcast tonight, so Ooh. You can check that out. I'm also going to have an interview with Brian Polian, recruiting coordinator at Notre Dame, just about, hey, how do you recruit during this time? Like, how has this affected you guys in the operation? And so I'll have a story on that. And then I'm also going to be trying something a little different. I'm going to have a Zoom call with about a handful of Notre Dame's top recruiting targets, Will Shipley included. And we're just going to have a, 30 to 40 minute conversation, have fans get to know them a little bit better. And so that will be on our website this weekend, and real excited about it. We'll see how the Zoom thing goes. It could be a disaster and it could be really cool. I have no idea.
With you hosting, what can go wrong?
Oh, exactly. Well, I'll just have to use, I guess I don't have to use my cell phone. So true. I guess that's good, because I won't be going in and out.
Here's my final question. How many trips estimated you've been to Whataburger in the last week?
I have not been to Whataburger in the last week. I did go once, and I'm a big germ freak. They weren't wearing gloves, the people there. And some people might not care about that. I mean, I think people should care about that in this climate. But I was definitely like, I'm not eating this until I get home and wash my hands. So that's what I did. It was all worth it, though, and it was very, very delicious.
Very good.
You're staying off Bad Choice Road, Carter. I'm proud of you.
Thank you, Sean.
You're awesome. He is Carter Carls, the Fighting Irish football recruiting insider for the South Bend Tribune. We always look forward to our Thursday visits, and you did not let us down once again this week. Carter, stay safe, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right, guys. Appreciate it.
You are the man, Carter Carls, with a lot of good information. I love the Zoom idea with all those recruits. We'll have to watch for that story unfolding on IndyInsider.com. We'll take a break. It is 5:53. Sean and Darren with you. Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat from 96.1 WSBT and live on the Sports Beat app.
One question, five answers. This is the My Five Question of the Day on Michiana's Sports Leader, 96.1 FM, WSBT.
Today's My Five Question of the Day. If I could offer Sean a magical ticket to go back and watch five Notre Dame football games in person, which five would he choose? Let's start with number five.
There's some magical games to use that magical ticket with. I'm going to start with the 1988 Notre Dame USC in the Coliseum, number one versus number two, Tony Rice's 65-yard touchdown run down the sideline, among the highlights of the day in Notre Dame's 27-10 victory.
Ooh, all right, number four.
Number four, the 1992 Sugar Bowl, when the Irish beat Florida 39-28. That was the infamous quote that supposedly came from a waiter to Lou Holtz: "The difference between Cheerios and Notre Dame is Cheerios belong in the bowl." Jerome Bettis rumbled for 150 yards and three touchdowns in the victory.
Oh, boy. Wow, I don't remember that quote. That is bringing back some good stuff. Number three on your list of, if I could give you a ticket to a past Notre Dame game, what would you choose?
Well, Joe Montana broke my heart enough when he was in the NFL with the 49ers, so I'm going to go to one that we can all revel in, the 79 Cotton Bowl, when he leads the Irish from 34-12 down to defeat Houston. Of course, that was known as the Chicken Soup Game.
Mm-hmm. Game number two.
Game number two is 1993, Notre Dame versus Florida State. This is another number one versus number two. Notre Dame was number two, but they ended up number one for a week anyway when they beat the Seminoles 31-24.
Okay, and if I could give Sean a magical ticket to go back and watch five Notre Dame football games in person, which would he choose? And now, game number one.
Numero uno, 1988, Miami versus Notre Dame in Notre Dame Stadium. The Irish, of course, prevailed 31-30 when Pat Terrell knocked down the potential game-winning two-point conversion, Catholics versus convicts.
That is a great, great list. All right, Sean, thank you. Something that just came across, according to a Denver television station, Von Miller tested positive for COVID-19, recently felt sick and went to Bronco doctors. They haven't said anything else other than that, but that just came across within the last couple of moments. We'll step aside for a minute, wrap up this hour next on 96.1 WSBT and live on the SportsBeat app. It is the top of the hour. We'll talk to Notre Dame baseball coach Link Jarrett live next on 96.1 WSBT South Bend.
Welcome back to another hour of Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat.
Touchdown Notre Dame! 70 yards, Book to Lindsey.
He gets it out to Leshesky for three.
Got it! He got it!
Caught for the win! Kyle Rudolph!
From 96.1 WSBT.
Justin Fisher heading for the touchdown, his sixth of the night.
The Washington Nationals are World Series champions.
And that's a South Bend Cub Midwest League championship winner.
And the kick is good for the win. Pinheiro with the De Niro kick.
The sports leader.
And look who's coming up.
Here are your hosts, Darren Pritchett and Sean Stiers.
And SportsBeat continues, brought to you by Budweiser, Rossini's Pizza, the Food Bank of Northern Indiana, on 96.1 WSBT, and we're live on the SportsBeat app on this Thursday evening. Again, we are continuing with SportsBeat from our homes. Sean, his home. I'm Darren Pritchett from my man cave in my home, and Jerry Janowski producing back in our WSBT studios. And this is day number 35 of working from our homes under the new norms. Well, right before the spring season was halted due to the pandemic, we had Notre Dame baseball coach Link Jarrett on the program talking about the amazing start to their season. And when the season was halted, the Irish were 11-2, and they had just completed a three-game sweep of North Carolina, a nationally ranked Tar Heel team down in Chapel Hill, and then I believe had beaten Radford in a midweek game, and were still on the road when the season was canceled. And we are very gracious that Link has offered a couple more moments of his time with us here on WSBT Radio. Link, it's Darren. First of all, let me say on behalf of Irish fans, even though it was just a 13-game season, congratulations on the 11-2 season. A great first year for you at the University of Notre Dame. And I guess we're left to wonder what could have happened with this Irish baseball team. But first off, just congratulations on a great start to your tenure.
Well, thank you. It was fun. I mean, we've talked about what our goals were and just implementing our philosophies and thoughts. And you know, you're on the road. I guess we played in five different states. I read that the other day. Never crossed my mind. It's 13 games, five states. And the way, like, each time we walked on the field, it seemed like we started to grasp what we were doing and got a little bit better. And it was fun. And the feeling we had, you know, playing as a team and getting more comfortable with each other. And it was something else. I'm just out here walking down my road, like, hard to believe that you're now in the situation you're in, and you went from really competing at a high level to just hoping people are healthy and safe, and our world is scary right now. But honestly, reflecting on what happened, it was remarkable, and you know, the use of the bullpen and the way Tommy Vaughn pitched out of the bullpen and it just completely changed the middle to late part of our games. And Boyle continued to develop and had some really impressive outings. Tommy Sheehan on Friday night, toe-to-toe with anybody. Watching Spencer Myers run the bases and take to our playbook. Like, our playbook is really built for guys like that, you know, and he can capitalize on some of the things we do. And for him to perform the way he did, and Prizman moving the shortstop and absorbing that. The poor guy didn't get to play at all this fall due to an injury. Miller going to second base and loved it. And Brannigan, a freshman, never played third base in his life. Some of the things he did at third base, just remarkable. So Brooks Cotey in right field, like some of the plays he made at critical moments, North Carolina, UAB, just phenomenal plays. It was really fun, and you don't know what you're about to play. Louisville, and their Friday night guy hasn't lost much in his entire career at Louisville, and you go from trying to figure out a game plan to how can you somehow distract this guy, and maybe it's the short game, maybe it's something on the bases, maybe it's something else, to figure out a way. Like I was so excited about what that was going to involve on Friday night, and you know, you turn the bus around and everybody's flying home, and that's where we are right now. It's just when you say unthinkable, I think we use some of these terms like unbelievable, unthinkable, and where we are in our world right now is exactly that, and it's reality. And you know, our dinner blessings revolve around the medical workers and the nurses and doctors that walk into those hospitals every day. And, you know, those are really the folks on the front lines trying to get a handle on this. And the people in the grocery stores that stand there for hours on end as people walk through to buy the essentials. It's like the truckers, like it's put a new perspective on who is really fighting this pandemic for us. It's remarkable, like just to transition from thinking about your own team and the performance to how thankful you are for some of the folks that you see every day and are now on the front lines. Incredible transition.
Yeah. Well said.
Link, you kind of touched on, you were in Louisville when everything really kind of went down. Can you kind of go through exactly where you were, you know, how you found out the season was shut down, and then kind of what happened next after that?
You know, we're in the hotel. You know, we played Radford, and we decided, like, there's some tough nights in our early season travel. Like, you're talking, when you talk 3 a.m., 2 a.m., 4 a.m., it doesn't matter whether you're getting up to leave or you're getting in. Those are some tricky times, and we decided after the Radford game, let's just bust to Louisville, and at least, you know, it'll be Thursday morning at 2 when we get there, but shoot, we can sleep and the guys can get up and we can practice Thursday afternoon and get a light lift in because it's spring break. So everything was on track, and it was a late night after a long game. So we were going to Louisville. We were actually going to have a light weightlifting session first, which is a little out of character for us. I like to do the weightlifting after we do our baseball activities, but it just worked out, and our strength coach was with us, so Kyle set up almost like a recovery lift that was going to be light, and it was also going to be our warm-up component, and then we'd go right out and practice at their field. So it was about, I think we left at 3 to kind of lift. I think we were going to lift at 3:30. And Jenny Borg called me from Jack's office and handed the phone to Jack. And Jack said, "Coach, you know, this is not good. You guys need to hang out at that hotel today." And I said, "Jack, actually, we're on the bus on the way to practice." I said, "You want me to turn this around? I'll turn it around right now." He's like, "Probably should." So we just literally pulled off on an exit and got right back on the highway. And the bus driver knew what I was asking of him. He didn't know why, but, you know, we need to go back to the hotel. So he pulled off and, we went back and, we met in a meeting room, and it was just unusual because at that point you think, okay, we're kind of going to sit tight here for a while. And it so quickly evolved into, "Coach, we need to get these guys on flights. We need to get you back to South Bend." So we spent Thursday night in Louisville. got up, drove back to South Bend, and Madison and Anthony Travel right there, basically right there by our baseball office, he was able to acquire flights for the guys that needed them, and we had everybody out of there either Saturday or Sunday. I think we had 5 runs to the airport to get the players really exited from South Bend. So they grabbed their essentials. And when we met as a team, after, you know, we got back to campus there, I thought maybe a couple weeks and we would re-engage this thing. You didn't think this was the end of it. And I didn't have exit meetings on purpose. Like, you're not prepared as a coach to have exit meetings when you're expecting to play a series. I wasn't at that point, nor did we know it was actually the end. So by Sunday afternoon, and I really wanted them, if it got to the point where Notre Dame wanted to close campus on Tuesday, I wanted our guys completely out. That exodus needed to occur, really, in my opinion, by Monday, because we're there. It's Friday. We're there. Like, they have nothing else to do but gather up and let's – because I sense something, obviously, not good was in the works. So that's how that played out. And now it's obviously evolved drastically, even from that poor scenario in the team lounge. Now you do anything to be with your team again and to, you know, tell them what the season meant, and to get yourself into the position we were in, and really be on the top of the ACC. I know you haven't played a lot, but somebody's going to win and somebody's going to lose, and the standings and rankings are what they are. And I think it hit some of our guys. Like, Coach, we were – like, do you know we were ranked, like, the best winning percentage in the league? And to be honest with you, I didn't know that. I'm not really thinking that way. So it hit them a little bit that they had accomplished something, even in a small segment of the season – to play that many road games in that short period of time with what we have to do in the preseason to prepare, never be outside to go play like that. Like, it started to hit them that they did something very unique and special.
Notre Dame baseball coach Link Jarrett, our guest on WSBT Radio. Link, the last time you were on our program, the season was still taking place at that time, and you were talking about the culture change and building the program. Now that the season is over, 11-2, 3-0 in the ACC. By the way, I'm looking forward to buying an ACC championship T-shirt with Notre Dame baseball on it, because you did go 3-0. So I'm going to buy one of those T-shirts. But seriously, how are you going to remember this season with this being your first at Notre Dame, building the culture and having success on the playing field?
Well, I had to really it starts with your coaching staff, and everybody was new. You know, Rich Wallace, our recruiting coordinator, he was new. We've never coached together. Chuck has been at Notre Dame for 10 years, fantastic pitching coach, but nonetheless, I'd never coached with him. And Scott Wingo, a national champion player, MVP of the College World Series. Again, I had never coached with him. And then we went through 2 directors of operations in 7 months. So the newest one was a player of mine at Greensboro, and actually was one of our assistant coaches. So I knew him, but he's not a coach. He's a director of operations. So you think about that group, number one, has to understand everything you're trying to do, and it's a complete overhaul of terminology, of systematic implementation, of tactics, and then they have to be able to relay that to the players. And getting 38 or 39 players to understand what you're trying to do with your warm-up routine, your individual segment of practice, your team segment of practice, and all the things that are in your playbook offensively and defensively. I just look at how my coaches and players absorbed and applied that information. You're talking about, in some cases, that takes a couple years. We're talking about a couple months.
Wow.
So, yeah, and essentially that's what stands out to me, and watching them enjoy seeing it happen in high-level competitive action was really the reason you got into coaching, to see the players perform maybe better than they thought they could. Individually and then as a team, and that's what I'll take away. I can go to each guy individually and think of moments that stand out to me. The culmination of that is that the team performed well. So that's what it means to me. It's really how quickly you were able to implement it, and then when you crank it back up, the great thing is you have so many people that have now been through it that you don't have to explain with such great length and detail why you're doing what you're doing. It starts to run itself. I mean, that's when you become a program, as opposed to this year, it was almost a team because we haven't been together long enough to really create the program where kids experience the same tactics multiple years. So that's what I take from it.
Well, and Link, something I just saw yesterday, Baseball America did a poll of college coaches, and they voted you one of the most underrated coaches in the country. So I'm curious what it means to you to kind of get that kind of distinction from your peers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what your peers think of you is probably the most important professional dynamic you have. And I've been in 6 different leagues, and I guess probably have won the leagues in 5 of those 6, and that's what stands out to me is can you do it in a lot of different areas, not one spot, but can you move around and still end up at the top of your conference? That's what means a lot to me. And you set out every year to, number one, help each kid be the best he can be, and then how do you win the league you're in? That's what stands out, and it meant a lot to me when somebody sent that to me and I read it. I had never thought that, I guess, as you're going through this and trying to do it the right way, and, you know, I fly under the radar a little bit. I'm not on Twitter, and I'm not sending stuff out all the time. I guess you just try to do it right and treat the guys right and coach the game hard, and it really meant a lot when I saw that. Really did.
Link, I just want to ask you about something that's, there's really no answer yet, but the Major League Baseball draft, there's a lot of speculation what could take place. I think there was a storyline it might be cut down to just 5 rounds. Now, I'm just going to ask you in general, because there's a young man in your team that a lot of people thought could be drafted after his junior season, so I'm not asking about him. I'm just speaking in general terms. How can that affect college baseball with Major League Baseball really not sure how they're going to hold the draft this year?
It's a tricky situation. It really is. A lot of this revolves around when they feel like they can get their season going. I'll say that. I think they've penciled this in a framework of when it should start, which is the first week of June. I've heard the latest they will have the draft is July 20th. So somewhere in that, I don't know if that 6 or 7 week window, they're having it. I think they're going to have it. I mean, if it gets past July 20th and they don't feel like they can pull it off, that's a whole nother layer. I don't think we get there. This revolves around the desire of organizations to trim their minor league system. That has been in discussion for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Each team really has 7 to 8 teams within the organization. So the Chicago Cubs have far more than just the Chicago Cubs. I mean, they have obviously the South Bend Cubs. They've got their AAA, their AA. They've got teams in the Dominican Republic.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of players. They've tried to trim that. So I think the timing of this unfortunate pandemic, it ultimately presents a situation where a short draft is going to flow into what they were trying to do with their organization anyway. Now, if they have a five-round draft, they're still going to have free agent signings. I don't think they've decided on the signing bonus cap for that yet,
mm-hmm.
but I've heard between $20,000 and $50,000. So how these clubs decide to utilize on top of the, let's say they have 10 rounds, are some of the players that might have been 11 to 15 round drafts, are they now free agent targets instead of being drafted? You know, Joe Boyle going into this season was really one of the most talented pitchers in the whole draft because mm-hmm. of body size, velocity, performance in the Cape, and projection. Like, part of the draft, it's a talent draft. So when you're projecting talent, it's their job to look 2, 3, 4 years down the road. What do you think this athlete becomes? So, you know, Joe is still in the upper echelon of, even if it's five rounds, you know, he's positioned himself well for that scenario.
Mm-hmm.
But there's many other guys on our team that were also in consideration for this, obviously, but you just don't know how trimming it from 40 to 10 or even five, like what that does. So in college baseball terms, it really presents a chance for guys to come back that may not have really been back. And it probably makes college baseball better.
Mm-hmm.
As long as we can get into this and play next year and play the fall and practice and do the things we do, like it probably makes it better. Like, if college basketball didn't have the one and done, like you're going to get guys that are back that maybe you didn't expect to have back, which makes the games more competitive or played at a higher level. So whether the guys are happy about that, I think in general the games of college baseball, if you get some of these upper-end older players back, it becomes a more high-level college game, if that makes sense.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Link, it sounds like the NCAA is going to be voting pretty soon on the one-time transfer rule. What were your thoughts on that idea before the pandemic, and has this current situation made you feel any differently about the possibility of that?
You know, I've been on these committees. Like, I was one of the 16 coaches last year on some of these panels. Of obviously, when you ask me a question, I'm going to give you a little deeper answer than you might want, but we've got plenty
perfectly
of time.
Fine.
I can walk into the season. I guess when we're trying to make an attempt to slow recruiting down in all of college athletics, I keep hearing we need to slow it down. We shouldn't have 8th to 9th graders committing. I agree. I 100% agree. So if that's how we feel, opening it up for people to freely transfer doesn't correspond to trying to slow the process down, because if I make a decision on a player and that player makes a decision to come to Notre Dame or wherever the guy's coming, you know you have a bailout mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're incorrectly applying that if we're trying to slow down recruiting. If we're trying to allow people to make better decisions on where they go, and coaches make a little bit more of a deep dive into the player and how he fits and all of the things that we look for in recruiting, like, are we really going to then say, if it doesn't work out, just go wherever you want? So I disagree with it, and sometimes we flip-flop on our rules. You know, there were years ago when you could transfer, and then we took that away, and now we're going to put it back in as we also try to put in mechanisms to slow recruiting down. So I disagree. This situation right now, if you wanted to allow kids to transfer right now because of the rosters, like this year is different as a rule. And to put that in as a rule going forward, I don't agree with it. That doesn't mean that it won't pass. But I feel like if we're trying to slow the process down for eighth and ninth graders, then we shouldn't allow them to make a decision knowing they can transfer freely at any time. I think it's a conflict of belief.
Great insight right there. Coach, we could spend another 2 hours talking to you, if not more, about the game of baseball, but we don't want to keep you too long. But we thank you for joining us, and again, congratulations on a great season, 11-2, 3-0 in the ACC, and you end the season with a 7-game winning streak. So congratulations, Coach. Thank you, as always, for your time, and we look forward to talking baseball with you very, very soon.
Thanks, guys. Stay safe. Thank you.
Thanks, Link.
Thank you. Link Jarrett, head coach of the Notre Dame baseball team, joining us on WSBT Radio with some great stories and great insight. We'll come back with Rapid Fire next. It is 6:31 at 96.1 WSBT and live on the SportsBeat app.
Rapid Fire starts now on Budweiser's weekday SportsBeat on 96.1 WSBT. Here is Sean Stiers and Darren Pritchett.
Darren, President Trump held a conference call with several members of the sports industry yesterday to discuss how resuming play in professional sports could go. The list of guests on the call, including people like Todd Ricketts of the Cubs, NFL owners Jerry Jones and Robert Kraft, all the major sports commissioners. Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban was on that call as well. And here are some of Cuban's thoughts, courtesy of ESPN.
It was more an introductory call and him asking us, you know, things that are important to us. And it was pretty unanimous that, you know, as soon as it's safe, we want to be able to go play games initially without fans. And so, you know, no new ground was broken, but it was great that he was open-minded and listening.
So are you confident that these actions are going to be driven by science and safety as opposed to the natural inclination of everybody just wanting sports back for entertainment?
Yes, I am. Yeah, I mean, I can only speak for myself, I guess, but I'm not letting my guys out there. The way I look at it, would I put my kids in that position? And if I would not risk, you know, if I thought it would be a risk to my family or children, you know, then I won't do it for the players either.
So, Darren, especially that last part from Mark Cuban, your thoughts on what you heard there?
I don't know if there's anything too surprising from those comments. You have to follow what the scientists are saying. You have to not go with your urge to get sports back out there quickly. It's got to be with the scientists in mind, from everything we understand with the Major League Baseball ideas, that federal agencies are behind the idea or the possible ideas to get baseball back going. I'm assuming the PGA Tour did something similar. So I don't know if there's really anything too shocking that came from those comments.
No, nothing shocking. I think it's a good perspective that Mark Cuban had, where he said, if, you know, and I think it's maybe the perspective that more of us sort of need to look at. Would I want my family out in that? Would I want my kids in that? You know, kind of look at it that way. We had these big protests in Detroit yesterday because there's this sort of new push to all of a sudden get things going once again and get people back out of their houses and try to get the economy driven and stuff like that. And I was just glad to hear that some of these influencers, and just reading quotes and stuff like that, there is still more a kind of cautious road that they are taking rather than just trying to rush forward. Because as you just said, within the last hour, Von Miller of the Denver Broncos has tested positive for the coronavirus. So more and more people that you see popping up every day. So I'm glad to see that it's still a cautious road and they're not putting dollar signs. These big owners and guys who drive the sports industry are not putting dollar signs in front of people's health and safety. All right, Brian Kelly was a guest on The Herd with Colin Cowherd today on FS1. So we'll start by letting Colin ask Brian Kelly the question.
Let me just ask you this. Fundamentally, structurally, if you had to play January, February, March, would it be a big pain in the butt, or could you kind of slide it down a little bit and make it work?
I think we could make it work as long as it wasn't. I think we have to get through this. We can't have an overlapping semester because then there's eligibility questions.
Okay.
That I don't know that we can really handle on the phone right now. So as long as there's not an overlapping semester situation, we can get through the semesters and everybody can tie up fall from winter and you know, spring from summer. I think we can do that. So I think there's enough models out there that we can get this season in. There may be some situations where, you know, we heard the other day that the mayor may not let anything happen in the city of L.A.
Yeah.
There may be some teams that have to play road games. And if that's the case, to play and get your season in at different sites, there may have to be those kinds of alterations to get a season in. We'll see what happens.
So, Darren, when you hear that, are you maybe increasingly confident that college football is going to be played one way or another, even if it takes pushing the season back several months?
It's hard to imagine football is not going to be played before next summer. I think there are many contingency plans, and as we've said a million times, the virus is in charge. But without knowing what truly is going to happen in the future, if it doesn't happen this fall, I think they're going to try with all their might to play the 2020 college football season in the spring of 2021, and we could have two college football seasons in 11 months with a couple of months separating them. But with all the money at stake, they're going to do everything within their power, understanding what we need to do from a social distancing standpoint. And again, there may not be any fans in the stands in early 2021. We don't know. But I think if I had to say one way or the other, before May 1st of next year, will we see college football again? I'll say yes.
And it seems like this is a good plan, or at the very least, it's good that they're having these discussions right now, that this kind of thing could take place. And you kind of hear more voices from college football, and the vice president did a separate conference call. Jack Swarbrick was on that call yesterday, the commissioners from all the different conferences, and they, and I'll read a couple of quotes here. Bob Bowlesby from the Big 12: "We made the point we were concerned and wanted to get back to having kids attending college and opening up our colleges and universities, and that until that happened, we weren't going to have any sports," end quote. Again, that's from Bob Bowlesby, the Big 12 commissioner. So it just, again, not putting the dollar signs out front, it sounds like they are sort of making deep plan contingencies for until students are on campus, there's not going to be any games played, and we do want to get these games played, even if it takes going into what would traditionally be the basketball season and the winter sports seasons. We've talked about this before. When this whole thing was starting up, I was more for let's postpone and put it off as long as possible before we cancel. And football, whether it's the NFL or college football, both have the benefit of some distance between now and when the season starts. Even still now, sitting here, we've got like 4.5 months before it's supposed to start. So I like the fact that they're making kind of long-term contingencies and considering some different options. But it does give me more optimism that the season's going to be played. It's just a matter of when, but not if.
Yeah.
All right, last question for tonight. There is baseball being played right now, Darren, even if it's in Taiwan. A member of the Rakuten Monkeys — I didn't know there were Rakuten Monkeys — but he hit 3 home runs yesterday to help his team beat the Uni President Lions. The last one was a walk-off shot. Have a listen.
Oh,
I'm going to guess that sounds a little bit different than the last South Bend Cubs home run you called. But
goodness.
My question to you, who hit the greatest home run you have ever seen in person, Darren?
In person? Oh, in man. Person. So are we talking about the actual home run or the person who hit it?
Either one.
Okay, well, I saw Albert Pujols hit two home runs in the same game in St. Louis against San Francisco. And since he's going to end up probably close to 700 home runs in his career, I have to go with him. I don't think I ever saw Barry Bonds in person. I was trying to think of that, but I don't think I ever saw Barry in person. So I'll say Pujols will be probably the greatest home run hitter that I have had the chance to see in person. From a South Bend Cubs standpoint, the most memorable home run I would say was probably Nelson Maldonado, game one of the championship series last year, 1-1 in the seventh inning of game one against Clinton, hit a solo home run, and that was the first South Bend postseason home run, and that kind of kick-started the sweep of that series and a Midwest League championship.
All right, some good ones right there. For me, I saw a Cubs versus Phillies game several years ago. Bobby Abreu for the Phillies and Sammy Sosa for the Cubs each hit three home runs in that game. So, you know, kind of one of those overall, not just a home run. In terms of the greatest, biggest impact of a home run, I mean, we used it on the Sports Beat 25-year anniversary. You had it in there in our open for several months, Brian Stavisky's College World Series run in 2002, the walk-off home run to give Notre Dame the win over Rice, was definitely the biggest moment, most dramatic home run that I've ever seen in person.
As I've told you before, that home run occurred as the Sports Beat Open was going that day, and we were watching it in studio, and as the show opens, we're screaming and jumping up and down as that ball left the ballpark. That was definitely the most dramatic opening to Sports Beat in our 21 years. That was awesome.
I can imagine.
I wish I could have been there to see that in person, and you lived it and you called it, as a matter of fact. Any better than that. That'll do it for Rapid Fire. When we come back, my good friend John Foster, the general manager of Warren Golf Course at Notre Dame, last week on the golf show, talked about 14 years ago when he drove down Magnolia Lane and was invited to play at Augusta National, the site of the Masters, but it took him a little while to get through the front gates. He tells the story next on 96.1 WSBT and live on the SportsBeat app. John and Darren with you, SportsBeat on WSBT Radio and the SportsBeat app. The golf show is heard every Saturday morning at 8 a.m. on WSBT Radio, WSBTRadio.com, and the WSBT Radio app. Last Saturday, I picked the brain of Warren Golf Course General Manager, and I had the chance to talk to Mr. Foster about going to Augusta National and playing the Masters 14 years ago. So John Foster, Tim Firestone, Darren Pritchett, our golf show from last Saturday, talking about a trip down Magnolia Lane. Well, since it is, or would have been, Masters weekend, one member of the crew has played Augusta National, and that would be Mr. Foster from Warren Golf Course at Notre Dame. First, can I ask who gave you the invitation?
The guy that built our golf course. He's been a member there, and his father was a member for years, and his son is now a member.
Okay. So you have played Augusta National. Here's the question I'd like to ask you that I've never asked you before.
Okay.
I'm visualizing arriving at Augusta National, and it is such a spectacular place. There's so much history. But I feel like I would be very uncomfortable there because it would be very tense and just a very intimidating moment. Is it like that at all, or is it more laid back than I anticipate?
I think it was intimidating going to the pulling up to the front gate, and I was with John Jasinski, who was our golf coach at the time, and the guy at the gate, a very nice guy, said, "I'm sorry, guys, you're not allowed to come on property right now. Mr. Warren has two guests with him, or he's at the guest. He had three guests with him until they leave, physically leave the property. You're not allowed to come on property."
Wow.
And I was thinking, oh, this is going to be a grind. If we're going to have to put up with this throughout the whole thing, So the other guests leave. We go up. Bill greets us. We're at Butler Cabin. And I've never felt more comfortable in my life. The staff members at Augusta National treat you like you're one of the family.
Awesome.
There was none of the snob factor. And I think what's interesting is that, say, Bill Warren, Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, whoever they are, who are members down there, they get no special treatment. They're treated like everybody else, and I think in a different kind of way, I think they kind of enjoy that. So I don't know if that answers the question there.
Yes.
I think everybody's equal there, and not that we're not normally, but sometimes you don't feel that way. But I never, from the time I got there till the time I left, felt uncomfortable at all or intimidated.
That's a great story. I did not know about that part of the story. So, Tim, can you picture John Foster playing Augusta National?
Well, the only visual I have is that, you know, my mentor in the golf business and one of John's greatest friends tells the story how he calls Foster on Sunday morning and asks him what he's doing. He says, well, I won't say what he said, but basically I'm sitting on the throne in the Butler cabin. So,
looking out the window at the 18th green, yeah.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and Brian was in this job for 3 to 4 years before I got here, and he's like, I never got an invite. And I said, there's probably a good reason for that.
Well,
John, that was my question. That was like, what, 7 or 8 years ago maybe? How long ago was
it,
that?
Tim, get this. It was 14 years ago.
No.
Yes.
Really?
So get this, guys. What I was going to propose is that we have people call in for a trivia contest on what year or what's the anniversary of this golf show this year, except none of us know the answer to it, so we couldn't really award a winner. We don't know, right, Garen?
I have no idea. I really don't. It's got to be 10 or 11, doesn't it?
I think so. What do you think, Tim?
I think it's more than that, isn't it? I don't know.
Well,
I
it just seems like
Phoenix
it.
In 2011.
Well, we know it hasn't been 11, 14 years.
12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19. That's probably 11 years.
Okay, because
wow.
John, I did not. Well, John wasn't a part of the show when he went to Augusta National, so we know it's been sooner than 14 years.
That's a good point.
All right, I got about 2 minutes left in this segment, so yeah. John, what ended up being your favorite hole on the golf course, and did it turn out to be the same as the one maybe you liked when you were watching it on TV?
Kind of. The 12, the par 3.
Yeah.
You know, obviously a huge difference in skill level and seriousness of the round and what's going on, but when you got there, as far as clubbing, you know, I relied on the caddy all day. They were really, really helpful. But I had no idea what to hit. I went from 9-iron to 6-iron, depending upon the wind. And it's the most docile-looking hole you can imagine. We've all seen it. And so I ended up, the first day I played, I hit 7-iron. And if you see the azalea bush about 10 yards up on the hill behind the green, that's where it ended up. And the second day, I hit 7-iron again and hit it in Race Creek. And frankly, in both times, I didn't hit it that badly. I mean, I hit it really good the first time. But that's how the wind swirls, and you really can't tell. And you're so unsure, I think it affects, you know, how you swing at it. So that hole was really cool watching on TV, and it was really cool to play it, too.
Okay, so final question. If you're playing back then, when you played Augusta National, the state of your game, if you played your best at Warren and you played your best at Augusta National, how many more strokes would you have taken at Augusta National?
That's a really good question. I mean, I played 3 rounds there. I shot 81 each time. We played I guess you would say, they hadn't lengthened the golf course yet, you know, to the degree that it is right now. But as you guys know, I mean, from tee to green, I'm not so sure Augusta wasn't easier than Warren because their greens are a lot bigger.
Yeah. But
once you get on the green, it's a totally different game. So let's say 6 to 7 shots probably.
Okay.
Yeah.
And just for clarification, the 81s were without a foot wedge.
No, they were, except I had a caddy doing it for me, which is even cooler.
Some of the ridiculousness and chaos from the golf show every Saturday. We'll try it again this Saturday morning, 8 a.m., a new installment of the Golf Show presented by Michelob Ultra on WSBT Radio. 6:57, we'll wrap up Sports Beat next from 96.1 WSBT and live on the Sports Beat app. Sports Beat brought to you by Budweiser, locally distributed by United Beverage of South Bend, who urges you to stay home, stay safe, stay fun. The Food Bank of Northern Indiana. Hunger is a story we can end. Find out how at feedindiana.org. Rossini's Pizza, carry out, you're proud to bring home. Lincoln Way East in Mishawaka, across from Beeger School. For Sean and Jerry, I'm Darren. 7 o'clock, WSBT South Bend.